Hello and welcome. Today I'm going to focus on an important new book by an American historian, Russell Stolfi, entitled Hitler, Beyond Evil and Tyranny. Stolfi is a professor emeritus at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and a retired colonel in the U.S. Marine Corps. And he's the author of other books of history, including one entitled Hitler's Panzers East, about the fighting and on the Eastern Front during World War II that was reviewed some years ago in the Journal of the Institute for Historical Review. Stolfi's new book has already generated some useful comment because it's an extraordinary book. The author states from the very beginning that he disagrees strongly with the interpretations of Hitler that are available in the standard, familiar biographies that are readily available, including those of Alan Bullock, Hitler, A Study in Tyranny, Joachim Fest, John Toland, and most notably, he's contemptuous of the new multi-volume biography of Hitler by the British historian Ian Kershaw, which has now become, you might say, the standard. Stolfi's thesis is laid out in the very first sentence of the introduction of his book. He writes, "After half a century, no biographer or historian has put together an adequate interpretation of Adolf Hitler." Now, Stolfi makes clear that he's not trying to write a new, detailed biography in the normal sense of the German leader, but instead he's trying to put the German leader in a historical perspective and thereby provide what he believes, and I think correctly, a much more accurate interpretation of the motives and character of the man than has been available in the biographies that are generally available. And even more so, Stolfi's book is an indictment of the interpretation of Hitler and of 20th century history that is the prevailing one, the common one, in motion pictures, encyclopedias, school textbooks, and so forth. Now, one of the main points he makes is that the standard biographers and the standard interpretation of Hitler starts with the assumption that he is an evil man, a wicked person who did evil things, and this makes it inherently very difficult, if not impossible, Stolfi writes, to provide anything like a real understanding of what the man was like. This is an important point because Hitler was not a consciously evil person, Stolfi points out, and instead acted out of motives that are explicable and understandable. The standard interpretation of Hitler, he makes the point over and over, is trying to portray him in keeping with the thesis that's already laid out by the biographers, already one they hold, and therefore the standard interpretation of Hitler is trying to make the facts fit the interpretation and not the other way around. And he gives several examples of the kind of bias that is commonplace in standard biographies and standard portrayals of the German leader. One of them is the tendency to play down and disparage any kind of artistic ability he had. And he makes the point that, in fact, Hitler had, this is the way he puts it. Along with the intensity, seriousness, and earnestness that underpinned him as a self-professed messiah, he brought artistic qualities of brilliance in architecture, competence in painting, and the interest of a cognoscenti in classical music. Now, this is objectively true, I think, to anyone who has studied or read very deeply, very much in detail, about Hitler's life. But over and over, the common portrayal of Hitler is to disparage or play down those facts as if they didn't exist. In other words, Many biographers, many portrayals of Hitler are not content merely to say that he was bad or evil or wicked, but that he was incompetent, that he was a fool, that he wasn't intelligent, that he was a coward, and so on and so forth. And Stolfi makes the point over and over that the starting assumption of many biographers and of the portrayal that's common in our society makes it very difficult, if not impossible, for these same people to provide anything like an objective look at the real qualities that he had and the achievements that he was capable of. He makes the point, for example, that although Ian Kershaw's biography of Hitler is, as he puts it, skilled and often brilliant, he fails to inform the reader of certain characteristics of Hitler indispensable for true comprehension of the man, and underestimates the importance of the conditions in Germany and in Europe in the aftermath of the First World War, which contributed to Hitler's rise. Well, this is, I think, exactly true and on point. He makes also the point that Ian Kershaw disparages and belittles Hitler for coming from an obscure, humble background. But Stolfi makes the point that this rise from obscurity in the case of Hitler that is played down or disparaged by many biographers, including Kershaw, is a trajectory that, in the case of other leaders in history, is praised and considered a very good thing. One obvious example, one obvious comparison, is that with Abraham Lincoln, who was a self-educated man and rose to become the president that's considered one of the greatest in American history, in spite of his humble background. But in the case of Hitler, his rise from humble background is held against him in a way that it's not in the case of others. Another example, he quotes with regard to his sensibility and sensitivity as an artist, a remark made by Albert Speer, the architect, in his memoirs. Speer writes, "In conferring with me over plans, Hitler perpetually drew sketches of his own. They were casually tossed off, but accurate in perspective. He drew outlines, cross-sections, and renderings to scale. An architect could not have done better." His point is to show that Hitler certainly had considerable artistic and architectural skill, and that efforts by biographers to disparage that are simply inaccurate and wrong, but understandable given the biases and the slants that they start out with. Stolfi goes on to say that the great biographers, again, Alan Bullock, Joachim Fest, and especially Ian Kershaw, take excessive liberties in denigrating his person, and in doing so, they make it difficult to comprehend him. A common bias, contempt for the subject of the biography, and a kind of arrogant fear of presenting any interpretation that might lead to greater comprehension, which could also be construed as apologia, invites an analogy between biography and war fighting. He says that the result, thanks ironically to the historical greatness of the subject, powerful minds gripped by a preconceived picture of evil have produced brilliant biographies, and every single one falls short of producing an adequate understanding of Hitler as a historical person. To this point in time, the biographers have lost the biographical war. In emphasizing Hitler as a man bent on aggrandizement of power, rather than concentrating on the vision that drove his accumulation of power, the biographers steer us away from historical analogy as a tool for comprehending him. In these sentences that I've already quoted, Stolfi has made a great contribution to understanding this extraordinary person. But he does much more than that and gives a great deal of detail in that regard. He quotes the British biographer Alan Bullock, whose book, Hitler, A Study in Tyranny, has been used for many years in colleges and universities and in schools and in many libraries, and talks about how he portrays Hitler as a man driven by a lust for power. Well, as he points out, that's an entirely inadequate, even stupid, interpretation of the man. Hitler didn't acquire power, as Stolfi points out, for its own end or because he was a megalomaniac. He acquired power as a byproduct, as a secondary feature of his great desire to be a servant and savior of his people. His motives were to make Germany a great, prosperous, and honored country again, not to accumulate power, not because he needed or wanted that. And Stolfi makes the point and compares Hitler in that regard, in a historical sense, not to an ordinary politician striving for political office, but to figures in history like Julius Caesar in Rome, of Muhammad, of Jesus, of Napoleon. But Hitler, even more than Napoleon, was a man characterized by an enormous modesty, not by a man interested in power or glory for its own sake. Stolfi says that interpreting Hitler as a hate-filled egomaniac, the biographers, that is the standard ones, underestimate the man, misjudge the disruption of the times, and prove incapable of overcoming elemental hatred for the subject of their biographies, all in the presence of a man with the temperament of a modern styled prophet. In that regard, he makes the, I think, telling observation that Ian Kershaw, the British biographer, is unable to acknowledge even that Hitler was extraordinarily intelligent, and notes that at one point Kershaw refers to Hitler as certainly not unintelligent. Well, it's a double negative. Instead of just saying that Hitler was obviously highly intelligent, Kershaw only will bring himself to acknowledge that he was not unintelligent. On the subject of biographies in general of Hitler, because what we're talking about is not really facts but interpretation and presentation, over the years I've been often asked if there's any single biography of Hitler that I recommend more than others. And over the years, I have generally responded to that question by recommending the biography by John Toland, an American historian who received actually a Pulitzer Prize for his writing in history, and whose biography was a bestseller when it came out in the 1970s. John Toland strived for objectivity in a way that Alan Bullock and Ian Kershaw have not. There are weaknesses in John Toland's biography, but it's a very well-written book, and I think far more objective and far more successful in presenting Hitler as an understandable way, in understanding his motivations and his character in a way that many of these other biographers have not. John Toland gave a presentation at an IHR conference some years ago, and I got to know the man somewhat. He gave me an autographed copy of his own biography of Hitler. And during the presentation, John Toland spoke about his background, his own, what motivated him to become a historian, and what motivated him in writing history the way he did. And the presentation, the text of that, is available on the IHR website, and is also available from the IHR as a recording. Stolfi goes on to mention how the biographers of Hitler generally available are constrained not only to present Hitler as evil, but as uniquely evil. And again, this is part of the weakness of them. With specific regard to, well, he quotes at one point, with stubborn uniformity, one biographer presents Hitler as a one-sidedly shabby, wicked figure who coveted power and presents the historical situation as one in which a legally bedecked European status quo of 1919 had come under attack by a German leader with the qualities of an international criminal. Such an interpretation, which can be generalized as a battle between good and evil in European international relations from 1933 to 1939, is unrealistic. Hitler does not stand up to scrutiny as either intellectually inferior or consciously evil. Well, this is quite accurate, I think, to anyone who has cared to look into Hitler's life and his career in any detail. One of the most common assertions made about Hitler, and this is repeated very often in standard reference books and by people in classrooms and so forth, is that Hitler was a demagogue, a so-called rabble-rouser. In fact, Hitler was just the opposite of a demagogue. Far from telling crowds of people what they wanted to hear, Hitler often told people what they did not want to hear. He was much more in that regard, a prophet or a messiah, Stolfi writes, and time and time again would take a stand on an issue that was principled, based on his view of the world, regardless of whether it would bring him immediate advantage politically. And in fact, one of the most notable things about Hitler before he took power was how few promises he made, unlike standard politicians, and certainly different than those politicians who we regard as demagogues in the normal way. So that Hitler often very much talked not about specific promises he was making, but in more philosophical ways, in larger ways, about the kind of society he wanted, the kind of nation he wanted, the kind of people he wanted Germans to be, and what they were capable of. And the specifics are things that he was much more reluctant to talk about. In fact, just the opposite of what demagogues do, and what American politicians generally do in making all sorts of promises that they think will attract as much voter support as possible. With regard to evil, Stolfi makes the point that in his youth, in his teenage years, and notably in the years during the First World War, in fact, on all the years before he came to power, Hitler's character was not that of a psychopath or a criminal. All those who remembered Hitler from those years spoke of him universally as being modest, well-mannered, a person who was unfailingly polite and respectful of other people. There was nothing in his background to show that he was psychotic or that he had done things like been a thief or liar or had cheated people or attacked people or been violent in any way that would be indicative of a person who's normally called evil. Now, he says that he was a young man, he devoured opera, classical music, he painted, he sketched, he planned a great new city of Linz, his hometown, he wrote sonnets, communed with nature, and he unfailingly showed politeness and reserve in his dealings with other people. These are activities and qualities that suggest potential, although overblown, aspirations to artistic genius. What we see, Stolfi writes, like it or not, is morally laudable behavior and aspiration on the part of a young man in his teens. Well, of course, already again, for writing these sentences, Stolfi has struck out with an interpretation, a perspective on Hitler that has generated a great deal of comment. Now, one of the most remarkable things is the shift that's already taking place in the interpretation of this man, as exemplified by this book, and also, I think, shown by the way in which people have been responding to the book. To go back to another point that Stolfi emphasizes very strongly, is the record of Hitler as a soldier during the First World War. Very often, historians and biographers pass over, or almost in silence, or only very fleetingly talk about his role as a soldier during the First World War. But his record as a soldier was an extraordinary man, an extraordinary one. He volunteered immediately after the outbreak of war in 1914 and stayed in the war military until the very end of the conflict. In fact, at the end of the war, Hitler was in a military hospital recovering from a poison gas attack that had left him blinded. But he was wounded in other ways during his wartime service. It was, to use that overused word, miraculous that Hitler survived the war as well as he did. At one point, the regiment that he was a part of was so devastated in battle that it lost 70% of its force. 70% of the men in it were either killed, wounded, captured, or missing. And Hitler, over and over again, was on the front line in some of the most ferocious fighting of the First World War. His record during the war was noted and with repeated medals and citations for his bravery and his service, accumulating in not only the Iron Cross Second Class, but the very unusual distinction of a man of his rank receiving the Iron Cross First Class, which was a very high award for valor and courage, but also very unusual, especially a man of his rank. And Hitler never boasted to people about his wartime record. He was very modest about his record as a soldier, as a frontline soldier during the war. But historians have overwhelmingly, and biographers have overwhelmingly, passed that over in silence, because to highlight it would be to highlight features of Hitler's personality that they would find difficult to reconcile with their portrayal of him as a man who was morally deficient, who was evil, who was stupid, and so forth. Going on, Stolfi makes the point, emphasizes the context in Europe during those years, and makes the point that any German leader, whether it was Hitler or anybody, who was going to be successful in restoring Germany's prosperity and place and position in Europe, was necessarily going to be a man who was going to overturn the punitive and unjust Treaty of Versailles that was imposed on Germany after the end of the First World War. A treaty that, in its injustice, in its punitive nature, was recognized as an unfair, unjust, and untenable treaty, an untenable treatment of Germany by everyone across the board, not only in Germany, but by foreigners as well, who recognized that the peace treaty imposed on Germany was a betrayal of the promises made by the Allies to Germany when Germany surrendered in 1918. Well, we'll take a break at this point and come back in a few minutes with the second half of this broadcast. Hello and welcome back. In this broadcast, I've been focusing a great deal on a new biography of Hitler by the American historian Russell Stolfi, entitled Hitler Beyond Evil and Tyranny, which is itself an expression of a trend that I think is inevitable, a trend toward greater objectivity and understanding of Hitler and of 20th century history. History, they say, is written by the winners, by the victors. And the interpretation of World War II that was set in place at the end of World War II, especially by the three major victorious powers, has changed and will change even more because the position and place of the victorious powers has also changed. The three great victorious powers of World War II were the British Empire, the Soviet Union, and the United States. Well, the British Empire has disappeared, and the Soviet Union has vanished and broken up, vanished from history and broken up. Now, the United States is still in place, and what this means is that the interpretation of World War II as a great crusade of righteous and victorious countries against an evil empire of Hitler is one that will inevitably give way to a more balanced one because the place of the victorious powers has also changed. And that's why there's more objectivity about World War II in the countries of the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe than there is in Western Europe and certainly in the United States. And this is reflected, this changing view, in the response to Stolfi's new book. One review that appeared that was very critical was by the Kirkus Reviews, which is often cited and used by librarians to decide whether this or that book is going to be added to a collection. But reflecting the prevailing view, the Kirkus Review was very harsh in its dismissal of Stolfi's new biography. In fact, the Kirkus Review calls the Stolfi book repellent and as deranged as its subject. But in order to make the point, the reviewer himself or herself shows the very bias, the very lack of objectivity, the very lack of understanding that Stolfi has been criticizing. For example, the Kirkus Review writes, "Against all evidence, the author, that is Stolfi, also proclaims him, that is Hitler, a wonderful painter and a superb architect." Well, that's not what Stolfi writes at all. He says that Hitler was a capable painter and showed great skill in architecture, but he doesn't call him a superb architect. The Kirkus Review deliberately exaggerates and distorts what Stolfi actually wrote in order to set up a straw man that the Kirkus Review can dismiss. But more important than, I think, this one very critical review have been the favorable, appreciative reviews that have appeared by authoritative and competent, capable historians. One of them is a review by professor of journalism at Brooke College, the City University of New York, named Carl Rollison. He reviews biographies regularly for the Wall Street Journal and the Minneapolis Star Tribune and other newspapers and periodicals, and Rollison is the author of a dozen biographies himself. He's reviewed this book for the Minneapolis Star Tribune and also online for something called Bibliobuffet. But Carl Rollison is very appreciative of Stolfi's new book, and that itself is a remarkable thing, because he feels that he can dare to do that. And the mood in the country has already changed, I think, enough that favorable reviews of this remarkable book by Stolfi are now not dismissed in the way they might have been 10 or 20 years ago. As Rollison points out, Stolfi situates Hitler in the context of world history, comparing him, for example, to Julius Caesar. He makes the point that in the decades-long Gallic Wars, Caesar's armies killed 1 million men and sold another 1 million, including the aged women and children, into slavery. But historians don't look at Caesar or Napoleon or Muhammad or other world historical figures in the simplistic good or bad way, the Manichaean good and evil way that historians are required virtually in our society to look at Hitler. And this is the big difference that Stolfi and increasingly other writers are presenting. They're looking at Hitler as a historical figure, not as the evil enemy of World War II. And this trend, therefore, of greater understanding and objectivity about Hitler is therefore, I think, an inevitable one as World War II recedes into the past and the generation that was alive and involved in World War II dies off. Rollison points out that Stolfi's takes an extraordinarily radically different view of Hitler's anti-Jewish views. He makes the point that Hitler's views about Jews and their role in society wasn't based on hatred, wasn't based on an emotional reaction to being mistreated by a Jewish peddler or mistreated by some Jewish dealer. But it's based upon his observation and his assessment about the Jewish role in society when he was living in Vienna and then later in Munich. In other words, it wasn't a hateful or a subjective one, but was based upon the view that Stolfi thinks and presents evidence to show was an understandable one, that Jews wanted Germans no longer really to be Germans. Jewish challenge to Germany and to the rest of Europe would mean inevitably the end of Germany and of Europe as a distinct European culture and civilization, and its subjugation into a kind of universal world culture. Hitler's view about the Jewish role in society was tremendously influenced by the effort by Eastern European Jews to impose a Marxist, even Soviet Marxist, rule over Bavaria and over the rest of Germany in the aftermath of the First World War. And this was especially true in Munich, where Jews set up a Marxist Republic and then even proclaimed a Soviet Republic in Bavaria. This was not only contrary to the wishes of the overwhelming population of Bavaria, but was represented no more than a tiny number of aliens who wanted to impose this radically different version of society. For Hitler, who was an ardent nationalist and a patriot, a person who loved his people, this Jewish communist effort to impose an utterly alien form of society in Bavaria and in Germany was just underscored how dangerous the Jewish role in society was, as Hitler saw it and as Stolfi tries to understand that. Now, contrary to what many people think, Hitler didn't hate Jews because he regarded them as inferior. This is a commonly repeated idea that is completely untrue. In fact, in Mein Kampf, Hitler expresses a kind of admiration for Jews for maintaining their identity in the face of tremendous pressures to disappear or to assimilate over the centuries, and what he calls an enormous will to live of the Jewish people, the Jewish nation. But that makes Jews, therefore, all the more formidable an adversary. Ascribing to Hitler hatred for Jews as inferior is not only unfair, it's utterly untrue. Stolfi writes that, in a sense, there are two Hitlers. One is the creature of propaganda, like as presented in the treatment by hostile biographers and American encyclopedias and on television and so forth. And the other is this heroic figure, which is how Hitler was viewed by his own people during the time he was the leader of Germany. Each portrayal of Hitler is an extreme one. He's portrayed either as utterly evil and wicked and criminal, or he's portrayed as a messiah, as a savior, as a man of extraordinary genius and courage. And Stolfi says that given his record and given his personality, it's impossible to portray Hitler in any moderate middle ground way, that the choice we are left with is a cruel interpretive choice, he writes, between either a bad man who did some good or a good man who did some bad. And that means that it's very difficult to be balanced or objective about a personality this extraordinary in history. Stolfi also makes the point, as I was mentioning earlier, that Hitler was exactly the opposite of a demagogue or a politician in the normal sense of the word. Stolfi writes, "A demagogue tells his audience what it wants to hear. A messiah tells his audience what he wants it to hear." It's remarkable in that way how time and again Hitler's views about issues were based on a larger principled view in which he turned down opportunities for short-term political gain by sticking to this messianic principled view that ultimately was crowned with success. One of the biggest mistakes made by standard biographies and portrayals of Hitler is to treat him as a politician intent on gaining power. But Hitler didn't seek power in the way that politicians normally do. He had a vision for his country and for Europe, but especially for Germany as a prosperous, unified, cultured people, a people of honor in Europe, that required the accumulation of political power. This is not something that Hitler sought or wanted as an end in itself, certainly not for his own aggrandizement. His personality, Stolfi makes this point over and over again, was really more that of an artist or an artistic temperament that was not interested in power at all for its own sake. Another reviewer who has praised Stolfi's new book is a retired Air Force officer named Colonel Lonnie Ratley. And his review of Stolfi's book is also appreciative and laudatory. And he focuses on another important aspect of Stolfi's book, the context in Europe at the time. Stolfi makes the point over and over again that any German leader that was going to restore prosperity and honor and unity for Germany was compelled to take measures that meant overturning the punitive Treaty of Versailles imposed by the victorious Allied powers at the end of World War I in violation of the pledges that they had made. The Treaty of Versailles, imposed on Germany by the United States, by Britain, and France, was a complete violation of the promises that those countries had made when Germany laid down its arms in November of 1918. And the injustice, the essential injustice of the Versailles Treaty was acknowledged by Germans across the political spectrum, whether right, left, even the Communist Party of Germany, all across the board recognized or regarded the Versailles Treaty as utterly unfair and unacceptable. Now, Hitler didn't overturn the Treaty of Versailles because he was engaged in a criminal enterprise, as so many biographers portray, but
the overcoming and setting aside of the Treaty of Versailles and its provisions was a necessary one if Germany was to have any restoration of its place in Europe that was at all honorable and just. And beyond that, though, Hitler was very determined to try to avoid another catastrophic war like the First World War that he had experienced so harshly firsthand as a frontline soldier during the years of that war. So that he made repeated offers and repeated proposals to Britain and France and other countries for agreements that would ensure that there would never again be a war as there had been in 1914 to 1918. In the spring of 1936, Hitler offered the French a 25-year non-aggression pact, which included France being assured of the boundaries of Alsace-Lorraine, for example. When Germany reintroduced conscription in 1935, Germany did so only after pointing out that its neighbors had had conscription and a large standing army for years. And Hitler offered first to maintain Germany's very small military force with no airplanes, no submarines, an army limited to 100,000 men, if the victorious Allied powers would agree to a similar and comparable reduction of their military to that of Germany. Well, France refused, Poland refused. And in 1933, when Hitler took power, Germany was surrounded by countries with very large military forces. France, even Czechoslovakia, and Poland had very large military machines in place compared to that of Germany. And Hitler, the only way out of that situation was to either Germany would have to build up its military, or there would be a general reduction of military power throughout Europe. And Hitler repeatedly proposed that that be done, which was, after all, in accord with the promises the Allies had made after World War I. But those offers were rejected over and over again. And it was only after the rejection of those proposals that Germany began building up its own military. Germany made also a naval agreement with Britain in 1935, in which Germany agreed to a navy that would be no threat at all to Britain's navy, but which would be larger than the one that Germany had. In fact, after World War I, Germany was prohibited from having any kind of real naval force. The German-British naval agreement of 1935 was itself a violation of the Treaty of Versailles that Britain acknowledged. And in making the treaty with Germany, Britain acknowledged indirectly or implicitly that the Treaty of Versailles was unfair, untenable, unworkable, and outdated. This view about Hitler, this new and radically different view about Hitler and his place in history, by Russell Stolfi in his new book, and as seen by reviewers who have praised the book, is not only a more historical view, not only one more that takes a longer range view about Hitler and his place in history, and of 20th century history in general for that matter, it's also in accord with the remarkable praise for the accomplishments of the Hitler government made by foreigners during the years before the outbreak of World War II in 1939. As I've mentioned on other occasions, the eminent British statesman David Lloyd George, who had been Britain's prime minister during the First World War, made an extensive tour of Germany in late 1936. And he returned to Britain filled with praise and wonder for what Hitler had achieved. He wrote, "Whatever one may think of Hitler's methods, and they are certainly not those of a parliamentary country, there can be no doubt that he has achieved a marvelous transformation in the spirit of the people, in their attitude towards each other, and in their social and economic outlook." He rightly claimed at Nuremberg that in 4 years his movement had made a new Germany. It is not the Germany of the first decade that followed the war, broken, dejected, and bowed down with a sense of apprehension and impotence. It is now full of hope and confidence, and of a renewed sense of determination to lead its own life without interference from any influence outside its own frontiers. "There is, for the first time since the war," David Lloyd George wrote, "a general sense of security. The people are more cheerful. There is a greater sense of general gaiety of spirit throughout the land. It is a happier Germany. I saw it everywhere, and the Englishmen I met during my trip and who knew Germany well were very impressed with the change." One of the another astute person who observed Germany and visited Germany during those years, who had a similar view, was the American aviator Charles Lindbergh, who was not only an outstanding aviator, famous for his solo cross Atlantic flight, but also was a respected and honored writer for his for some of the books that he published. And he visited Germany during those years, and although he didn't agree with everything he saw in Third Reich Germany, in particular he disagreed with the regime's Jewish policy, all the same he wrote that he felt that Germany was the most interesting nation in the world today, and that she is attempting to find a solution for some of our most fundamental problems. "While I have still many reservations," he wrote in a letter to a U.S. Army officer who is a personal friend, "I have come away with a feeling of great admiration for the German people. The condition of the country and the appearance of the average person whom I saw leaves me with the impression that Hitler must have far more character and vision than I thought existed in the German leader, who has been painted in so many different ways by the accounts of America and England." In a letter to another American friend, Charles Lindbergh wrote, "With all the things we criticize, he, Hitler, is undoubtedly a great man, and I believe he has done much for the German people. He is a fanatic in many ways, and anyone can see that there is a certain amount of fanaticism in Germany today. It is less than I experienced, but it is there. On the other hand, Hitler has accomplished results, good in addition to bad, which can hardly have been accomplished without some fanaticism." Lindbergh's wife, Anne Morrow Lindbergh, who was a remarkable woman in her own right, an accomplished aviator and successful author, wrote to her mother in 1936. She wrote, "Hitler, I am beginning to feel, is a very great man, like an inspired religious leader, and as such, rather fanatical, but not scheming, not selfish, not greedy for power, but a mystic, a visionary, who really wants what's the best for his country, and, on the whole, has a rather broad view." This perception of Hitler by Anne Morrow Lindbergh is entirely in keeping with the spirit and the content of Russell Stolfi's amazing new biography of the German leader, a book that's well worth reviewing and reading, and which I recommend, and which is more important not just in and of itself, but as a landmark of a trend that I think is inevitable and which will become more and more pronounced in the years ahead. Thank you for joining me for this broadcast. I hope you'll join me for future installments of the Mark Weber Report, and I welcome your comments, letters, criticisms, and suggestions. Thank you.